Sam said, leaning his head against mine as we two-stepped almost in place. You smell so good.
Thanks to you, I whispered, and hoped he'd remember that the year and my Chanel were both nearing the end. A good hour or so into the party, I was able to corner Lisa Hudson in the dining room, where she was getting a second helping of Ida Lee's congealed salad. As we both edged toward the foyer, I casually asked about the local real estate market and got the usual answer from a realtor. Everything was down, nothing was selling, people were delaying listing properties, and so on. It'll pick up in the spring, I said to encourage her, but then turned and saw Pastor Robert Rucker and his wife Lynette being welcomed by Mildred. They were slipping off coats in the foyer and laughingly making their excuses for being late. We got caught at the Homes for Teens, Pastor Rucker told Mildred, as if that would be a perfectly acceptable excuse to her. He didn't notice the way she squinched up her eyes and tightened her mouth. You understand, I know, he went blithely on. A pastor's work is never done. Well, Mildred said quite graciously, I hope my party doesn't count as more work for you, but I'm glad you're here. We're still serving, so go right on to the dining room. Oh, Lynette said, her eyes sparkling as she looked at the crowded rooms. It's not at all work to come here. Your home is just so elegant, and Robert and I could hardly wait to get here. I held my breath, hoping that Mildred would let that pass without reminding Lynette that all they'd had to do was make a choice. Being reminded by the Ruckers of the reason for our parties on this particular day, I took note of the number of young, smart, and capable professional women who were enjoying Mildred's hospitality, every one of whom was generous with her financial support of worthy causes. I also noted, in comparison, my contemporaries, also smart, capable, and generous, but whose activities had been limited to keeping house, volunteering for church and civic responsibilities, and rearing children. I knew that Madge would have loved to have attracted anyone from either group to her project. Mildred and I had successfully forestalled that, at least temporarily, but somehow I didn't feel so good about our success. On the other hand, I always felt a glow of satisfaction and maybe a tinge of pride after a social event that had gone smoothly. And now Mildred and I each had another one to our credit, although I wasn't feeling so proud of either of us. It wasn't until I thought again of how Madge was continuing to arrogantly defy the zoning ordinance that I was able to justify my pleasure in Mildred's lovely party. Chapter 31 Sam and I braced each other as we walked home across Mildred's lawn, the snow-tipped grass blades crunching under our feet. The snow had stopped, having left a glistening coat of white on bushes and lawns. A few drifting clouds moved across the moon as we picked our way home. The hour was late, for we had stayed until all the guests had left so we could discuss the day.
I think we did what we set out to do, Mildred had said, summing up my feeling as well. I talked a little with Lynette Rucker, and I'll have to say, Julia, that your preacher's wife has a lot to learn. She's either unaware of what's going on, or she has no tact. I asked her straight out about Madge's tea, and she raved over the house and what they've done to it. She even said to me, you should have been there.
Oh, my, I said, rolling my eyes just a little. She just doesn't think before she speaks, or maybe the pastor hasn't told her anything. Did she say how many were there?
She mentioned a number of pastors who dropped in.
Probably from the seven churches.
Mildred nodded. Probably. Lynette said they were to be commended because a pastor's Sunday afternoons are usually reserved for a nap.
Well, I said, laughing, Sundays are their busiest days, but I expect they'd rather not have their nap times known. Who else was there, did she say?
Hardly anybody. She said Madge was teary-eyed when they left because Madge said the town had turned its back on children who had no place to lay their heads.
That just flew all over me. How like Madge to denigrate the town, specifically Mildred and me, I knew, instead of acknowledging her own responsibility by choosing an unsuitable location. Sam interrupted my recollection of our debriefing session by saying,
I'm planning to talk to Binky tomorrow and find out where she is on that house. From what I picked up from Pete Hamrick tonight.
Who's he?
One of the commissioners. You know him.
Sam grinned.
At least I hope you do. You voted for him. He's a real wheeler-dealer. Always has an ear to the ground. Anyway, he's heard that a few boys are about to be moved in, maybe within the next week or so. He seemed fairly sure that the commission will be asked to grant a variance to the zoning, and he's dreading having to make a decision on something that's so controversial.
Oh, my goodness, Sam, I said as we stepped into the house and began to divest ourselves of coats and gloves. What are we gonna do?
Prepare to speak against granting any kind of exemption, which, as I'm sure Binky's warned you, will, as a public meeting, hit the papers and divide the town.
And, I added, label us selfish and immoral. Oh, Sam, why couldn't Madge have done it legitimately in the first place? And why couldn't the zoning board have told them from the start that they couldn't use that house? Could have been stopped in its tracks at the beginning if people had simply done what they were supposed to do.
I know, Sam said, a worried frown deepening. But what concerns me now is Pickens. He said that if that house is allowed to function as planned, he'll sue the Homes for Teens Board of Directors as a group and as individuals for loss of value to his house and for anything else he can think of. He'll do it, too, because he doesn't care what people think of him.
That's because he's gone half the time, I said, shivering from the cold. He doesn't have to see people day in and day out. But Hazel Marie and Lloyd do. Then, heading out of the room, I said, I'm turning up the thermostat. It's cold in here. After turning up the setting a notch or two, I walked on into the library, switched on a lamp, and stopped dead in my tracks. Sam! I cried, then called him again, unable to take in what I saw. He ran in, calling,
What is it? What is it?
Then he, too, skidded to a stop at the sight of what had been done to our beautiful room. Cold air was rushing in through an open window. Chairs and a sofa were overturned. Papers from the desk were strewn across the floor, all of which I had taken in with one sweep of my eyes. Now they were trained on the most unbelievable object taking pride of place right in the middle of the floor. Is that what I think it is? I asked, pointing to the yellowish-brown swirled blob dead center of my mohawk carpet.
Oh, my word, Sam said, mopping his face with his hand. Yes, I think I can safely say that it is.
Swallowing hard, I said, Oh, Sam, who would do such a thing? We've not only been broken and entered, we've been desecrated. Oh, let's get it up. Let's get it up right now.
No, Sam said, taking my arm and urging me out of the room. Leave everything as it is. We have to call the sheriff.
He turned to leave, murmuring,
Phew, glad my photos were upstairs.
Closing the library door behind us, Sam went to the kitchen phone while I looked around to see if any other room had been equally profaned. Thank goodness the rest of the house seemed undisturbed. But what had been done to and in my favorite room was far and away more than enough. He would have thought that he'd have used the bathroom. It was right next to the library. Who would have done such a thing? Who could have done such a thing? It would have taken an analytical mind of uncertain status to figure out when the house would be empty, then to synchronize his own body clock in order to be prepared to make his daily deadly deposit.
I declare it beat all I'd ever heard, seen, or smelled, and I was so outraged that I was ready to take up arms. Instead, though, I waited with Sam for a swarm of detectives to arrive and take charge. I'd wanted to call both Sergeant Coleman Bates and Mr. Pickens, but Sam assured me that we'd hurt the feelings of the on-duty detectives if we did that. So we waited in the kitchen while officers with flashlights scoured the yard for evidence. The guilty scoundrel, whoever he was, had broken a pane in a side window near the back of the house, reached in, and unlocked the window. He'd slid it open, crawled in, and done his business, and hadn't had the courtesy to close the window behind him. The officers found footprints under the window outside the house, but they were mostly mush in the melting snow. Nobody was sure if they could be matched, although I heard one officer tell the chief detective that the prints came from running shoes, of which there were thousands of pairs in Abbotsville alone. Chief Detective Warner asked Sam to come into the library and gather up the books and papers strewn all over the room. "Let me know," he said, "if anything's missing." There wasn't. For most of the papers concerned Sam's trip, receipts from hotels and restaurants, pamphlets he'd picked up on his travels, and notes he'd made. He went around the room, scooping up all the items that had been on the desk, then left them in a pile on a bookshelf for later sorting. They were now out of the way of trampling feet, but bless his heart, nobody but him would want any of it. Two other detectives occupied themselves with brushing black powder over the window, the windowsill, the desk, and even the furniture legs, most of which were sticking straight up in the air. Remarkably, though, after the fingerprints, which turned out to be mostly smudges, were taken, those same detectives righted all the furniture and put those legs right back in their indentations in the carpet. In doing so, they carefully made wide circuits around the object occupying the center of the room. As they snapped their satchels and cases closed, Detective Warner spoke to me. "Mrs. Murdoch, we're sorry you've had such a scare, but since you say nothing else has been ransacked and nothing taken, I think this was just a random act of vandalism." At my expression, he hurriedly said, "Not that that isn't bad enough, but you're unlikely to have a repeat visit." "Let us hope not," I said, unable to stop wringing my hands. "But what about..." I turned and pointed at the center of the room. "That." "Well, that's unfortunate, but fairly typical of a vandal."
"Aren't you going to take it with you for DNA testing?"
He looked startled for a second, then smiled in a slightly patronizing way. "We usually reserve that test for major cases. It's pretty expensive, you know."
"Send me the bill."
He stared at me for a minute, then turned aside. "Hey, Mac," he said, stopping a passing officer. "Be sure to get a specimen from..." He turned and pointed to the center of the room. "That."
"Get more than a specimen," I said. "Take it all, why don't you? Just in case."
After they'd left, Sam closed and locked the window, a little late, but even so. Then he stuffed a pillow in the gaping space where a pane of glass had been and anchored it with masking tape.
"I'll get this repaired first thing tomorrow," he said. "And I'm calling a locksmith to put keyed locks on all the windows. I don't want to come home to something like this again."
"Me either," I said, as I scrubbed the carpet on my hands and knees. "This is the worst thing in the world. Who could have done it, Sam?"
"Anybody passing by and seeing an empty house with a party next door, I guess."
"Well, I'm just thankful that there were no presents under the tree. He surely couldn't have resisted lifting a few."
I sat back on my heels, wiped my forehead with my arm, and said,
"Sam, do you think we were targeted? I mean, a lot of people were at the party, so there were a lot of empty houses around. Why was ours chosen?"
"Honey, there's no telling, and no need to worry about it. There's unlikely to be a repeat performance."
"Well, a lot of people could be unhappy with me because of how I feel about that house next to the Pickenses, and maybe about a few other things.
Images of Helen Stroud, Madge Taylor, and Pastor Robert Rucker, all of whom had reason to hold umbrage against me, flashed through my mind. But I, even in my outraged state, had to smile at the thought of any of them leaving such an unlikely calling card as the one we'd found.
Chapter 32.
Julia, Sam said as we sat at the breakfast table the next morning, I'm convinced it was just random vandalism, as the detective said, and a young vandal at that. Think about it. No real damage was done other than one broken pane in the window. Nothing else was broken, and nothing was taken. It couldn't have been a professional looking for something to steal.
You're right, I agreed. He didn't take anything from us. He just left something for us.
Law, Lillian said, who was as shocked and disgusted at what we'd found as we were.
That just run all over me. What be in somebody's mind to do such a thing?
It's usually viewed as a message, Sam said.
Usually, I asked. You mean it's done a lot?
Unhappily, it is. And it's usually a message of disdain to express his feelings toward the owners, even though he may not even know the owners. In other words, it's not necessarily a personal message. The perpetrator feels put upon and resentful toward the world in general, and it's his weak-willed way of getting back.
Well, for goodness sake, I said, you'd think he could come up with a better way to leave a message than that.
Actually, Sam said, turning his coffee cup around in its saucer, he did.
Glancing up at me, he went on.
I wasn't sure I should mention it, but he left a note. I found it this morning when I was going through the papers he'd strewn all over the floor.
Of course you should have mentioned it. What did it say?
He reached into his shirt pocket and held out a folded pamphlet featuring a picture of some bare, ruined abbey he'd visited in Europe. Along the margin in black magic marker, a message had been printed in wiggly letters. Quit being a jackass or else.
I gasped, then thrust it in front of Lillian. Look at this. Does it bring anybody to mind?
Yes, ma'am, she said, her eyes wide as she looked up at me. It most certainly do.
Later that morning, while thinking of what Sam had said, I realized that he'd been trying to allay my feelings of having been deliberately targeted. He had not succeeded because I was convinced that we, or rather I, had been the focus of the depositor. And furthermore, I had identified the perpetrator to my satisfaction and to Lillian's as well. We knew who had been in our house, and between us, Lillian and I recounted to Sam the run-in Lloyd had had with Sonny Taylor.
It's still a guess, Sam said, urging caution before we accused the rascal. A good guess, most likely, but it's not proof.
I finally conceded that it was best to leave it alone because nothing had been stolen or irreversibly damaged. As Sam pointed out, the newspaper and television news would have a field day with a court case based not on fingerprints, but on bowel contents. After considering the possibility that our elegant library might be referred to as a roadside rest stop, I sighed in defeat and put aside my desire to publicly accuse Madge's son.
And, Sam had gone on to say, I wouldn't mention my suspicions to anybody, honey. That would only lay you open to a charge of slander, which if I know Madge Taylor, she wouldn't hesitate to use.
But my desire to deter Madge in her headlong rush to fill the Cochran house with teenage boys was not lessened. I was convinced that she needed to have pointed out to her the irony of caring for somebody else's children while her own so desperately needed attention.
That conviction was reinforced when I called Mildred to tell her how much we'd enjoyed her party, and also, of course, to tell her of the unusual gift left for us while we'd been gone.
It took a while to get through because her phone was busy for a couple of hours, most likely by guests thanking her for the party. But finally I dialed her number at a fortuitous time and was able to pour out my tale of woe.
"What kind of a sick mind would do such a thing?" Mildred said, aghast at what I told her. "Oh, Julia, I'm so sorry that happened. Do they know who did it?"
"Not yet, but we have our suspicions, and with modern scientific methods they may eventually find out for sure. But you know, Mildred, as bad as it was, it's even worse to think of somebody disliking me so much. It makes me want to hide in a closet or something."
"Well, don't do that. It would please Madge too much. She called me a little while ago, all upset about hardly anybody showing up at her tea. She just wanted to tell me that even though she'd been disappointed, she didn't hold it against us that they'd preferred our parties to hers. Then she said, people knew they wouldn't get alcohol at a home for children, as if getting liquored up was the only reason they came to my house. Can you believe that?"
"That is just so typical of her. She has a way of saying the worst things in the nicest way possible. I think it's a gift some people are born with."
"Maybe so, but I'm glad you called because I was going to call you. Madge told me something else that you should know. In fact, I think she intended for me to tell you."
"Oh, my.
Well, go ahead and tell me."
"Well," Mildred said with a large intake of air,
"it seems that she attended a meeting at the Department of Social Services this past week. It was with the counselors and social workers who oversee foster parents and foster homes. Madge said it was a meeting to finalize plans for the Cochran House, and as such they'd invited several homeless boys to give them an idea of what was in store for them." I moaned. "Well, I knew it was about time they'd begin doing something. One of the commissioners told Sam at your party that the board was going to be faced with a request for a zoning variance. He said he's not looking forward to it, which means he's on the fence. Pete Hamrick, you know him?"
"Yes, and I wouldn't trust him as far as I could throw him."
"For goodness sakes, why?"
"I don't trust anybody who laughs as much as he does, especially when there's nothing funny. He just acts too happy to suit me, like he knows something you don't. Hidden agendas," she said darkly. "As far as I'm concerned, the entire board of commissioners has to be watched like a hawk. They know what's going on and what's about to go on, and they're usually in on whatever it is."
And I thought I was cynical. But I didn't want to go down that track, so I got us back to the subject at hand. "Mildred, Madge is simply going to bulldoze everything in her way, and I don't know that we can stop her."
"Well, hold on to your hat," Mildred said, "because that wasn't the worst thing she told me. And I've just now put two and two together. She told me that she'd poured out her heart at that DSS meeting, warning them all that there were some active naysayers who were fighting tooth and nail to deny those children a home. And Julia," Mildred stopped for another breath, "she didn't say that she'd actually named anybody, although she did refer to close neighbors and some not so close. But what I'm wondering is, if she in some way let your name drop, and one of those at-risk boys decided to get back at you."
"Uh-huh," I said, restraining myself from mentioning the boy most at risk. "And I think you may just be right. Our house was empty during the party, but the Pickens' house was full, which might have been his preferred target. But Lloyd was there, and his two sisters and Granny Wiggins and James, and of course Ronnie. But after all the crazy things Mr. Pickens has done, no one in his right mind would tackle his house, which means that mine would be the next best thing."
"Oh, you're right about that. But do you,"
Mildred went on in a mock sorrowful tone, "you should know that they're praying for all those who are so hard-hearted that they'd turn children out in the cold.
By the time Madge finished her talk, she said that everybody, even some of the boys, were teary-eyed at the spitefulness of a few selfish people. That means you and me, you know.
Yes, I know, and it's driving me up a wall. It's as if there's no other houses in town not only suitable, but more suitable for a group home. She makes it sound as if it's either the Cochran house or no house at all. And they either don't know or don't care that we're simply reacting to what Madge has done, and done illegally. It all started with her.
Well, prepare yourself, because Madge said that the boys were so moved and so hurt that they're going to write letters to the editor. They want everybody to know how they've been looking forward to having a real home, especially for Christmas.
Oh, my goodness, Mildred. It's just accelerating out of control. We'll be portrayed as the worst of the worst. Scrooges, even. But, I went on, taking a deep breath in spite of the pain in my chest, we've always known that Madge has a way with words, and she's able to move people to act while she stands aside to watch the fallout.
After that unsettling conversation, I had to force myself to do something besides cover my head and curl up in a corner. So Madge had maneuvered a way to lay blame for opposition to her plans onto me, and I'd gotten the brunt, if that's what you wanted to call it, on my library floor.
With a heavy heart and in an effort to carry on as I normally would, I took my Christmas list upstairs to Lloyd's room to use his computer. Yes, I was ordering a lot of my gifts online, feeling guilty as I did so for not patronizing local merchants. I did it not necessarily to save money, but to save wear and tear on knees and feet. To have to park blocks away, then tromp up and down Main Street, going in and out of shops, carrying packages as I went, just seemed beyond my declining physical ability. I have mentioned, haven't I, that age is creeping up on me. Looking for shortcuts and ease of getting things done seemed the obvious way to proceed. There were a few things, however, that I intended to purchase in town, the thought of which helped assuage my guilty feelings. Sam would help with those errands. He might even do them by himself. But that was my tired, defeated feelings coming into play. If I wasn't careful, I would let Madge and her wayward plans overshadow my entire Christmas. To forestall that, I forced myself to go to the telephone and call Lou Ann. As she usually called me with a suggestion, I thought it time that I return the favor. "Let's go to lunch," I said when she answered. There was a long pause before she responded.
"Oh, well, I don't think I can. I mean, I know I can't. I'm on my way to the church for a meeting."
"This late in the morning? It's close to lunchtime."
"I know, but everybody's so busy these days. It's always catch as catch can. You know how it is."
Then, in a rush, she said,
"It'll be a short meeting, just to hand out lists of names to be called. But then we're supposed to start calling right away, this afternoon, in fact."
"Oh, well," I said, disappointed that I wouldn't have Lou Ann to distract me over lunch. "We'll do it another time. But what's the church calling everybody about?"
"Pledges, Julia," Lou Ann said in an exasperated tone. "We'll be calling the members who haven't returned their pledge cards. I don't know how people expect the church to operate if it doesn't have a budget. And to have a budget, it has to know how much will be coming in."
Well, I thought, that was another can of worms to open. Does one support a church that supports lawbreakers? Promising each other that we'd get together soon, we hung up, and my conscience had something else to struggle with and to pray about. Chapter 33.
"I caught up with Binky this afternoon," Sam told me as we sat in the Febreze-scented air of the restored library after supper that evening. "And you don't have to worry. She's well prepared to argue against a variance."
"So that means," I asked, lowering the newspaper, "that Madge and company are definitely applying for one?"
"That's the way it looks. Nothing's on the agenda yet, but the commissioners are expecting it. Binky says that the petitions you and Hazel Marie collected from the neighbors are a great help. She had copies made to send to each commissioner. Half are up for re-election next year, so they'll pay attention.
Oh, I don't know that they will. They'll figure that everybody will have learned to live with the homes for teens by that time.
Sam shook his head. Maybe not. If the commissioners allow the variance, they know it'll strike fear in the hearts of all the town citizens. If one neighborhood isn't protected by the zoning laws, who's to say anybody else's is? At least that's the main point of Binky's argument. She knows what she's doing, Julia. You can depend on her.
I'm glad to hear it. I was beginning to have my doubts, although Binky has never failed me before. It's also a relief to know that I won't have to speak at a public hearing.
Don't be too relieved. I expect Binky will want several of us to go to the microphone and speak against the variance. Just as you should expect, the other side will have their own speakers.
Yes, and every one of them will tug at the heartstrings of the commissioners and probably cry a little, as if the Cochrane House is the only possible answer for homeless teens in all of Abbott County.
Well, Sam said, reaching over to pat my knee, the next commissioner's meeting is still a couple of weeks away. We have plenty of time to get our ducks in a row. Why don't you write out what you'd like to say, and I'll write mine to support your points.
I'd really rather, I said with an almost unforced smile, that you write both of them.
Laughing, he agreed, and I was comforted by having his strong presence and orderly mind to rely on.
Sam, I asked after several minutes of listening to the news, which seemed to be much the same every night, what are your thoughts about pledging this year?
His eyebrows went up. To what?
To the church, Sam. You know, so the deacons will know how much they can spend.
I guess I haven't given it much thought, Sam said vaguely. We've always pledged something, so I expect we'll do it this year, too.
You've probably not thought of it because the pledge cards came while you were away. Yours is in your desk drawer if you want to fill it out. Sam gave me his full attention then.
Do I detect a tiny bit of reluctance from you about making a pledge?
More than a tiny bit, I admitted, but I was trying not to influence you.
Sam and I kept our finances separate, mainly because he had no desire to live off Wesley Lloyd Springer, whereas I had no qualms at all about spending the proceeds from my first and unborn husband's estate. We therefore contributed to the church on the basis of our separate incomes.
What's going on, honey?
Sam lowered the volume on the television and turned to me.
What's the church doing that's upset you?
What's it doing? I asked with a touch of sarcasm. Let me count the ways. Besides openly supporting an illicit operation, no one is the least interested in hearing from the other side. I'm feeling ignored, overlooked, and patronized. Then, from that introduction, I told him of my chance meeting with Kenneth Whitman, who had pretended to be sympathetic to my cause, but had really been shrugging me off. And, I went on, there are a few hints that something else is going on undercover. Another instance, you might say, of eventually announcing a fait accompli, and I want nothing to do with it. Having told Sam of the Finance Committee's misuse of church funds by donating to Madge, I now told him of Pastor Rucker's asking if we would serve on a relocation committee. When I turned him down, I said, getting it all off my chest, he asked me what Jesus would do. And Sam? That almost stopped me, until Lloyd reminded me of the Good Samaritan. So I told the pastor what Jesus would do, and as far as I'm concerned, the subject is closed. I laid it all out for him, but whether it got through to him or not, I don't know. He that hath ears to hear, let him hear. Matthew chapter 11. And to also quote from memory, I went on. That's all I have to say about that.
Sam smiled.
Matthew again?
No, Forrest Gump. Then tentatively I ventured to say, but you may feel differently.
Oh, I doubt it, Sam said. I'm not much for jumping on a bandwagon without knowing where it's going.
Exactly, I sat straight up on the sofa, energized by Sam's putting into words what I was feeling. That's exactly why I'm reluctant to pledge for all of next year until they tell us what they're going to do with it. Just this very afternoon, Pat Lowell called me. You know her, don't you? Her husband's retired from some big corporation in Chicago, so they're fairly new in town. Anyway, she was calling members who usually make a pledge but who haven't turned in their cards, of which I am one. She wanted to know if I was unhappy about anything, and I just told her straight out that I was holding off because I'm concerned about some things the church is supporting. Then I asked, doesn't that worry you? And Sam? There was dead silence on the line, and then she said, quite firmly, no, it doesn't. Well, I had to laugh, because it was so abrupt and unexpected, but speaking bluntly is typical of your average northern retiree, as you know. Anyway, I had a good mind to tell her in that case she should just double her pledge to make up for mine. Anyway, I said, sighing, I guess I'm feeling misunderstood and unappreciated, and to top it off, I've lost a friend. Sam put his arm around me and said, you always have a friend, but who are you talking about? I had already told him about that shameful intervention to which we'd subjected Helen. I still feel awful about it because I jumped onto somebody else's idea without looking into it or realizing what the outcome could be. I mean, of course she was offended. Who wouldn't be? And why didn't I see that from the beginning? I don't know. I guess I thought that it was something I could do rather than sit by and watch the train wreck as I seemed to be doing with the church.
Honey, Sam said, listen to me. Let the church go its way. It'll do that anyway. We're members of the real church regardless of where our letters of membership are. As for Helen, you two have been friends for too many years to end it all because of one little misstep, made, I remind you, with her well-being in mind. You've prayed about it, and you've apologized, groveled more like it. Okay, groveled then, Sam said, tightening his arm around me. That's all anybody can do. Now let me tell you a funny story that's making the rounds down at the Bluebird Cafe. Clara MacDonald is getting married again.
What? I sat straight up, my worries completely pushed aside. Why, Sam, she's 90 if she's a day, and she's already been married a number of times.
Four husbands in all, he said, and buried every one of them. But this is what's funny about it. Her new beau has about outlived his retirement fund, so he couldn't afford a wedding ring. Instead, he took her four previous wedding rings and had a new one made using all the stones. Word is that she's thrilled with his originality and his financial management skills.
Well, my word, I said, trying to picture Wesley Lloyd's measly little stone in a new setting. We could probably use him on the finance committee at church.
Having successfully lightened the mental load I'd been carrying, Sam took my hand as we made our way upstairs to bed. We'd just crawled between the covers, though, when my mind switched on to another unpleasant image. Sam, something else has been bothering me.
Oh, really? Sam said, pulling the comforter over his shoulder. Now I wonder what that could be.
Well, I'll tell you. But don't fall asleep until I do. I don't want to dream about it tonight.
I slid up close to his side and went on. I've been thinking about that DNA specimen that Detective Warner took, and I think I know why he wasn't all that enthusiastic about taking it.
He said it was very expensive.
I know, but that couldn't have been the reason since I'm willing to pay for it.
No, I think the problem is that they don't have a database or whatever it is to compare our specimen to others of the same kind. I mean, how would they collect and keep enough specimens to run a comparison? It would take an awful lot of refrigeration.
Sam didn't say anything for a few seconds. Then he started laughing.
Honey, let me tell you something. DNA is DNA wherever it comes from. Scrapings from the mouth, blood, saliva, or wherever. They don't need a database of the, well, let's say, of the specific material.
Oh, I said, and as I thought about the intricacies of collecting and storing such material, which that would have entailed, I too began to laugh. Mortified by my own density, I buried my face against his shoulder and said, "Oh, my goodness, of course they wouldn't have a storehouse. Oh, Sam, I don't know why my mind runs away with me like that."
"Oh, I know why it does," he said as he shifted in bed to put an arm around me. "It's to keep me entertained. And now my mind's running the same way. Can't you just see it? An officer brings in a suspect and tells him to empty his pockets and his bowels."
And with that final bit of first-grade humor, we laughed together like children. Chapter 34. Have you ever awakened early in the morning, too tired to get up, yet unable to go back to sleep? That's the way it was for me the next morning, so I lay there for a while, trying not to disturb Sam as I shifted from one side to the other. I felt terrible, and that was the truth. As if a heavy weight were dragging me down, or maybe a thick, dark cloud were wrapped around me, and not even the thought of Clara's new engagement could lift my spirits. I knew what it was, a nagging fear that I'd been in the wrong on several recent fronts. For instance, had I been wrong to hire an attorney, collect names on a petition and engage Hazel Marie, Mildred, and Helen in an attempt to oust Madge Taylor and her merry band of do-gooders from the Cochran house? Had I been wrong to collaborate with Mildred to foil Madge's plans for a self-congratulatory come-fundraising tea? Had I been wrong to virtually accuse Helen of malfeasance, or misfeasance, or nonfeasance, whichever applied, to how she was conducting Thurlow's affairs? It was only in considering the last question that I squirmed with shame and regret. How could I have set myself up in judgment of a friend? How dared I to presume that Helen was running through Thurlow's capital like Sherman through Georgia? I would have been stricken to the core if a friend had demanded an accounting of my actions, especially the financial ones. As for the rest, I could let myself off the hook by claiming an honest difference of opinion on a perpetual sore spot. When, where, and how much to help the poor whom we are told we will always have with us, especially where, as in the case of the Homes for Teens, that is not next door to the Pickenses. So with a partially placated conscience, I slipped out of bed without waking Sam and went downstairs to start the coffee. By the time Lillian came in, I was sitting at the table, still in my gown and robe, nursing a cup of 8 o'clock coffee.
"What you doing up so early?"
she demanded, stopping as soon as she stepped inside. "Just woke up. But I could ask you the same thing. Why are you here so early?" She proceeded to the pantry to hang up her coat and put away her large pocketbook, talking as she went.
"I can't let Lord go off to school without a decent breakfast, and this his day to do that tutoring he'd do."
"We could send him back to his mother's and let James get up early," I suggested with a smile.
"Huh, that James too lazy for that,"
Lillian said as she tied on a large apron and started breakfast.
"Sides, Lord like peace and quiet early in the morning. He don't get that with them two little girls running around.
He tell me he need to get his mind set up right before he tackles Freddie Pruitt in algebra. You want some more coffee before I scramble the eggs?
No, I'm fine, thank you. As Lloyd pushed through the swinging door to the kitchen, I went on. Here he is now. Good morning, sweetheart. I hope you slept well.
Yes, ma'am,
he said, yawning as he put his backpack on the floor and slid onto a chair at the table.
Just didn't get enough of it.
How long will you be doing this? Getting up early, I mean, to tutor Freddie.
Till Christmas break, at least. I want to see how he does on his midterms, then we'll see.
As Lillian put a plate of grits, eggs, and bacon before him, he smiled.
Oh, man, this looks good. Thanks, Miss Lillian.
She patted his shoulder and said,
That boy lucky to have you helping him.
I don't know about that, he said, shrugging. He just got behind because his mother's sick or something. She's in a hospital somewhere, so he's staying with his aunt. I get the feeling that it's a big, noisy family, so it's hard for him to study.
I got hot biscuits here, Lillian announced. They just coming out the oven.
Oh, good, Lloyd said, quickly cleaning his plate and getting up from the table. Miss Lillian, could you fix me a couple of bacon biscuits, maybe about four, to take with me? He put on his heavy coat, then picked up his backpack to sling over his shoulder. I gotta go.
They already ready, Lillian said as she handed him a foil-wrapped package.
Lloyd said goodbye to us both, then hurried out to his bicycle, letting in a gust of cold air as he left. Turning to Lillian, I asked, What in the world was that about? Is he so hungry that he has to take another breakfast with him? Lillian smiled.
Took me a while to figure it out, but he taking breakfast to that Freddie. He don't tell me, but I know that's what he doing.
Well, bless his heart, I said, moved that Lloyd was so thoughtful, or rather so observant as to recognize hunger when he saw it. Lillian, is that Pruitt child not getting enough to eat? I thought the school served breakfast for needy children.
I know some of them do, but looked like to me at this time of a morning that boy got a choice between eating breakfast and learning algebra. And he choose algebra.
Well, bless his heart, too, I said, and went upstairs to dress for the day, carrying with me the heavy thought of hungry children who didn't have friends bearing bacon biscuits. I got to the top of the stairs, then turned around and went back down. Lillian, I said as I pushed through the kitchen door, let's try to find out more about the Pruitt boy. He's as thin as a rail and as pale as a sheet, and obviously not getting breakfast at home. I wonder if anybody's taken care of him.
Yes'm. I wonder about that, too.
Lillian turned from the sink, drying her hands on a Bounty towel.
I hear Lloyd say he had that aunt, and one time he mentioned a grandmama, but I don't hear nothing about a daddy. All I know is the Pruitts are spread out round the county, and that aunt live here in town, so Freddie looked like he had to change schools when he moved in with her.
Then it's no wonder he's having trouble with algebra. That's what happens when you change schools. Well, I said, turning to go back upstairs, that stunted child's thin face in my mind. See what else you can find out. I mean, if you hear of anything we can do, let me know. After a fairly busy day of running errands to the dry cleaners, the post office, the bank, and a quick stop at the drugstore for some Robitussin, because it was December and somebody would need it sooner or later, I headed for home. Pleased that I'd remembered to buy cough medicine, I thought again of the agony of trying to suppress a cough, particularly in a place of reverence. Have you ever noticed you never have to cough until you settle in a pew for Sunday morning services? On my way home, I had reason to wish I'd stayed there and never gone out at all. Passing the small, independent church that was known for latching on to every liberal cause that came along and calling it progression, I almost drove up on the sidewalk. Spread out across the front portico of the church was a large blue banner reading,
We stand with and for you, justice, freedom, and dignity for all.
Now just what did that mean? And why did they feel it necessary to restate what the Constitution already covered? And, I wondered, to whom was it addressed? The U seemed to cover everybody who read it, but that could be anybody, including fugitives from the law, active criminals looking for victims, or people like me who didn't need or want a group of strangers standing around getting in the way.
Well, of course I knew what it meant. It was that church's way of proclaiming its stance for anything new that popped up, the more outrageous the better. Politics, that's all it was. Which was all right with me, except I could do without their ostentatiously drawing attention to how inclusive they were. If they had wanted to be inclusive, then they should have just done it without expecting to be applauded for it. Then I had to laugh. Right at the entrance to the church parking lot was a permanent sign that read, "Church Parking Only." Standing with and for all, whoever that might be, was fine and dandy, just as long as no one took their parking places.
I drove on home feeling sad and excluded in spite of their banner, for I knew what they thought of me. Or at least I knew what their pastor thought of me and those like me. We were immoral and lacking in Christian compassion. He was the very preacher who early on had been quoted in the paper as supporting the homes for teens in Madge's chosen location, and the very one who had pointedly denounced anyone who disagreed with him. Well, what does one do? It's hard to reach a closed mind, especially a mind that never questions itself.
Chapter 35. Why couldn't everybody just get along? Why couldn't we live and let live without debasing those who disagree with us? Why couldn't we try to see the other side and treat one another as we wanted to be treated? Well, of course we'd been instructed to do just that long before my time, but a lot of good it was doing in the present circumstances. So, with a long inhalation of breath, I thought that maybe it was up to me to put it into practice. Maybe I should start by taking the first step toward mending a few fences. There was such a thing as common courtesy, you know, though there seemed to be a dearth of it currently, perhaps even in my own actions. To that end, I called Nell Hudson at A1 Realty, told her what was on my mind, and asked her to keep me informed. Actually, I didn't know where or how to start on repairing fences. Should I go around to the 7 churches and offer apologies for my angry thoughts? They'd think I was crazy. Especially because what I thought on any subject whatsoever wouldn't matter a hill of beans to any of them. I'd not actually done anything to anybody, except maybe to Madge and certainly to Helen. Nonetheless, I screwed up my courage to the sticking point, as somebody somewhere had described it, and called Madge Taylor. "Madge?" I asked when she answered her phone. "It's Julia Murdoch. Are you busy? I can call back later if you are." "Oh, no, don't do that. I mean, I'm always busy, but I have time to talk." "Well, good," I said, trying to order what I wanted to say without giving in completely. "Well, Madge, it seems to me that the two of us should try to come up with something that would accomplish what both of us want. You want a place to house homeless boys, and even if I haven't acted like it, I want you to know that I do, too. The problem arises with the location you've chosen. I mean, doesn't it bother you that your neighbors dislike your being next door to them?" "They'll get over it. We intend to be good neighbors ourselves, so they'll come around. Or," she said, and I could almost see her shrug her shoulders, "they'll move." I was stunned at her complete disregard of the legitimate concerns of her neighbors. And this was the woman who cared so deeply for the dispossessed and the disadvantaged. Keeping a tight rein on my temper, I continued in a modulated tone. "Madge, you know that the Cochran property isn't zoned for a group home, which is what you are, in spite of what you call it,
and your determination to stay there is what's causing so much upset. If you would consider moving to a more appropriate location, I will do whatever I can to help. And I mean help in any way possible. Couldn't we discuss the matter and come to some kind of an agreement?
What's to discuss? She said in a dismissive tone. There'll always be people who have no concern for the have-nots. We recognize that. So we know we'll always have that attitude to contend with. We've learned to live with it and go on doing what we're called to do.
Regardless of who it hurts?
Hurts how? Madge demanded.
Well, it hurts the neighbors by devaluing the investment they have in their homes. And,
well, see, that's your problem, Julia. You're always thinking in terms of financial gain. You don't think of those who don't even have a bed, much less an investment in anything.
A half dozen retorts ran through my mind, but I steeled myself to keep them unsaid.
That's not really true, Madge. I'm as concerned for the homeless as you are, but it seems to me that whatever we do for them should be within the bounds of the law. Doing something, no matter how beneficial, that's illegal, doesn't set a good example for those young boys you want to help. What's going to happen to them when the commissioners deny you a variance? How will you explain to them, especially to those who might have already run afoul of the law, that you've done the same thing?
Madge didn't respond right away, and I let my question hang in the air between us.
Let me just assure you, she finally said, that we are well within our rights to be there. Do you really think that we would have expended so much time and effort, and yes, money as well, if there was a possibility that we'd be forced to move?
She stopped and let her question hang in the air. Then she answered herself.
I don't think so.
In the white noise that rushed into my brain, one thought stood out. Rigged. It's been rigged all along.
Does that mean... I started and stopped, then managed to say, "Are you telling me that you already have a zoning variance?"
"I am not without friends, Julia, and I am not so stupid as to do anything without guarding against all contingencies. I've come up against people like you before, so I've adopted the Boy Scout motto, 'Be prepared.'" And with a soft laugh, she said, "I'm not only prepared now, I've been prepared for whatever roadblocks you or anybody else decide to throw up."
"Then," I managed to say, "I guess we have nothing to discuss. But," I went on with a little more strength,
"just remember that I tried to work with you. I tried so that we'd both get what we want. I'm sorry that only one of us will."
I hung up. Discouraged and dismayed, but also more determined than ever that I would be that one.
I replayed the conversation over and over in my mind and concluded that it was Madge's sense of smugness that most troubled me. She had not been interested in even hearing my side, much less in working something out to our mutual benefit. My offer to help in any way possible, which she would have correctly interpreted as financial help, had been completely ignored, which meant to me that she had all the monetary help she needed.
So where was it coming from? If Madge had bought the Cochrane house, where had she gotten the money in the first place? Even if each board member had contributed $1,000, there wouldn't have been enough for a 10% down payment, which meant that they wouldn't have qualified for a bank loan, and they'd had no public fundraisers before buying the property. So where had the money come from?
I called Binky and asked if she knew, or at least if she knew how we could find out. She was silent for a few seconds, then said, "Miss Julia, I apologize to you. I went to the Register of Deeds office when you first brought this to my attention, but the sale hadn't been recorded. Since then, I've been so tied up with a court case that I've not checked it again. I'll look into it as soon as I can, but it may be a while." She paused again, then went on,
It's unlikely, though, that the owner's name will tell you much, especially if the board of directors is listed as owners. It won't tell you how or where they got the money. It could have been a private loan.
But why would anybody do that? I asked. Who would lend a non-profit that much money? And how would they ever repay it? They exist entirely on gifts and government grants.
The more likely possibility, Binky replied, as I've mentioned before, is that it was an outright gift. After hanging up, I was more distraught than ever. I knew what the listing price of the Cochrane house had been, and I knew that the Cochrane estate might have accepted a low offer just to be rid of it. Even so,